Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., John Russell, and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
China is preparing to become the first country to launch its own digital currency. China's central bank has released few details of its digital currency electronic payment project. Work on the project began 5 years ago. Some observers say the DCEP shows both financial innovation and the government's desire to increase control over the movement of money. China's digital currency has similarities to Facebook's proposed digital currency, Libra, and existing cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin. Like those forms of payment, the Chinese currency will be stored in a digital wallet. What is somewhat different is that China's central bank will be able to follow where the money is going and even supervise trading. Observers say the goal of the project is for China to protect its economy at a time when newer payment systems could permit illegal money flows. Kuyu Jin is a professor at the London School of Economics. She said, "There's a consensus around the world among central bank governors and governments at large that they want to have control of money and money supply." She added that the strong desire for control is probably more unique to China than anything else. In September, China's central bank chief, Yi Gang, said there was no timeline for launching the digital currency and that more work needed to be done. The Reuters news agency reports that the People's Bank of China has sought legal rights to more than 50 inventions related to the digital currency. Chinese officials have not hidden their disapproval of Facebook's Libra. They have called it a threat to the sovereignty of China and other developing economies. China claims that digital currencies should only be provided by governments or central banks. Mu Changchun is the head of the Chinese Central Bank's Digital Currency Research Center. He has suggested that the new currency should be made available through commercial banks, just as physical money is. The digital currency will follow models similar to systems such as Apple Pay and the Chinese payment system Alipay. These require a commercial bank to put money into a digital wallet that can be downloaded onto a smartphone. Unlike physical money, however, a tracking system could follow the digital currency's movements from one person to another. Mu said the digital currency would strike a balance between anonymous payments and classified supervision. He said, the goal is to prevent illegal financial activities, with officials able to watch for such activity by studying huge amounts of information. Once we analyze these transactions, use big data and data mining technology, and conduct identity comparisons, we will be able to find the culprits, he said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
When Dina Espenscheid answered an advertisement on social media, her sister warned her that she could have problems. The ad was a weekend vacation to an unknown destination. The offer was not only real, but also a lot of fun. In fact, Espenscheid told the Associated Press that she had a blast. The West Virginia Division of Tourism organized the free trip earlier this month. The goal was to advertise West Virginia as a perfect place to visit during the autumn months. The social media ad said next to nothing about the destination. It suggested only that people wear layered clothes and strong footwear. It also recommended they have a sense of adventure. In parts of the United States, mystery trips have grown into their own industry. Whether traveling by bus, train, or airplane, these vacations have different lengths, costs, and destinations. Often, organizers give people a general idea about where they are going. But sometimes they do not. Denise Chekun Weaver started Magical Mystery Tours nearly 10 years ago. Her company now helps to plan hundreds of trips every year. There's this magical thing about a mystery trip in that you don't have control. You don't know where you're going, she said. Surprises are really fun. Other companies offering mystery tours include Pink Bus Mystery Trips, Pack Up and Go, and Surprise Me Trips. Rustic Pathways specializes in summer group tour packages for students. The group Dina Espenscheid went with enjoyed dinner, nature, and horseback riding. They visited the former coal mining and timber towns of Davis and Thomas. They watched musical acts at a former general store and spent the night at Canaan Valley Resort and Conference Center. By sunset the following night, Espenscheid was back home, and her sister did not have to worry any longer. I would absolutely do it again, Espenscheid said. It got me out of my comfort zone. If I can sign up for another destination unknown where I'm not planning anything, it's part of the adventure. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Can abuse, violence, and neglect during childhood affect a person's physical and mental health later in life? United States health officials say the answer to that question is yes. Researchers with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that childhood trauma can lead to many conditions and illnesses in adulthood. Traumatic experiences can also lead to a lower quality of life. Researchers found that such events can lead to fewer educational and employment opportunities in the future. The director of the CDC is Robert Redfield. In a statement, he writes, "We now know that adverse childhood experiences greatly affect an individual's future health." CDC researchers have been involved in other studies on this subject. However, this new report is the agency's first on the effects of this problem nationally. For the new study, researchers looked at 144,000 people from 25 states. They asked these men and women about their health problems and lifestyle choices. The subjects also were asked about childhood memories and if they had experienced or witnessed traumatic events. The CDC defines childhood traumas as harmful events that someone experiences from birth to age 17. Such events can include experiencing physical, verbal, and/or sexual abuse, experiencing severe neglect, witnessing violence in the home, having an unstable home life because of drug abuse, mental illness, or having family members in prison. The CDC statement describes the major findings of the study. It found that adults with the highest levels of childhood trauma had an increased chance of suffering long-term health problems such as heart disease, some forms of cancer, depression, and diabetes, smoking and heavy drinking, being overweight or obese, having problems getting a good education and employment opportunities. Researchers say it is unclear if some traumatic experiences are more harmful to a person's future than others. Also, health officials admit that the study does not prove that childhood trauma directly leads to future health disorders. However, many researchers say there is a well-established link between childhood trauma and health problems later in life, and they are working to develop ways to reduce the effects of traumatic childhood events. Dr. Dana Long is with the University of California, San Francisco's Benioff Children's Hospital. She calls trauma a public health crisis that everybody needs to start addressing. When asked about the CDC's new report on childhood trauma, she calls it critical. The report, she says, gives important information about the usefulness of preventive measures. Leading the CDC's violence prevention program is Jim Mercy. He says this has become clear. The more harmful incidents a child suffers, the more likely their health suffers later. He adds that there's a lot of evidence connecting childhood trauma and illness in adults. CDC researchers are working to better understand and prevent childhood trauma. They also say they are studying ways to lessen its negative effects. CDC officials say all parts of society can help. Government, church, and other community leaders can create effective social and economic programs for at-risk families. Schools can help to lessen the effects of childhood trauma and prevent trauma. Doctors, nurses, and other healthcare providers can recognize at-risk children, as well as signs of childhood trauma in adult patients. Employers can support family-friendly policies, such as paid days off for family emergencies. Prevention is one part of the fix. Another part is intervention. A positive role model in a child's life can have a great healing effect. Role models might be family members, friends, neighbors, teachers, religious leaders, or others in the community. Showing care and concern for a traumatized child can possibly put that child on the road to a healthier future. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. As we reported in our last program, slavery supporters failed to push through Congress a bill to make Kansas a slave state. Congress instead let the people of Kansas vote on the statehood constitution, written by pro-slavery men. The people rejected the Constitution, and slavery supporters gave up the fight for Kansas. Here are Steve Ember and Bob Doty to continue the story.
The problem of slavery continued to divide the North and South. Northerners warned that slavery could spread no farther. Southerners threatened to leave the Union unless Southern rights were protected. In the far West, one could forget this bitter dispute. There were no slaves in the West. The land and the weather were not right for the kind of farming that used slaves.
The West was growing quickly. Gold had brought thousands of settlers to California 10 years earlier. New discoveries of gold and silver now were leading men to Colorado, Arizona, and Nevada. "Don't go," warned the New York Tribune, "if you have a job or a farm. But if you have neither," it said, "and can get $50, then go to Colorado." There were many men without jobs or farms in the summer of 1858. The country had suffered a serious economic depression the year before, and jobs were difficult to find. Thousands left cities in the East. The first ones to reach Colorado reported that gold was easy to find. They said any man who worked hard could find $5 to $10 worth of gold a day, and sometimes even more.
The thousands who rushed to Colorado soon found that there was not as much gold as expected. The valuable metal became harder to find. No longer could it be washed from the bottoms of mountain streams. Men had to dig into the mountains of rock to get it. Huge digging machines and crushers were needed to get the gold from the rock. These machines were expensive. Few men had enough money to buy them. Some of the miners organized companies. They borrowed money from Eastern banks or sold shares of their companies. In a few years, almost all of the gold from Colorado came from the mining companies.
Many of those who went west to search for gold stayed to become farmers or storekeepers. Others moved farther west to find gold in Nevada or California. Some cleared the ground of trees and cut them into wood for houses. Such timber from the forests of Oregon and Washington was sold in California and Mexico, even in China and Hawaii. A few men recognized the need for transportation across the nation. Engineers planned four railroads, but northern and southern leaders could not agree on which one to build first. Until a railroad could be built, supplies were carried west in wagons pulled by horses or oxen. Three men, Russell, Majors, and Waddell, formed a transportation company in 1855 to carry government supplies to soldiers in the West. They started with 500 wagons. 3 years later, the company had 3,500 wagons and 40,000 oxen.
Getting letters to and from the West was not easy in the 1850s. Ships brought mail to San Francisco two times a month. And once each month, mail would arrive in California after a slow trip by wagon from St. Louis, Missouri. The federal government decided to send mail overland two times a week to California. It gave the job of carrying the letters to a new company, the Overland Mail Company. The mail was carried by train or boat to St. Louis. Then it was put on Overland Company stagecoaches, light wagons pulled by four or six horses. The company was told to take the mail along a 4,000-kilometer southern route through Arkansas, Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. The mail arrived in Los Angeles 24 days after it left St. Louis.
There was a shorter way across the country, but the postal chief was a Southerner, A.V. Brown. He believed stagecoach travel might lead the way for a railroad, and he wanted a Southern railroad to California. Brown said the Southern route was the only one that could be kept open in all seasons. He said the other routes would be closed by snow in winter. The overland stagecoaches were large enough to carry four passengers, but not many people went to California in the coaches. The coaches never stopped for very long, only to change horses or drivers. And there were not many places to eat. Also, the trip was dangerous because of hostile Indians.
The shortest distance between Missouri and California was across the central part of the country. The Russell, Majors, and Waddell Company decided to show that this central route could be used all year. It began a speedy mail service called the Pony Express. Letters were carried by riders on fast horses. Stations with fresh horses were built about 24 kilometers apart all along the way. A rider would change horses at each station until he had traveled 120 kilometers. Then he would give his letters to another rider. In this way, the letters would be carried between California and Missouri. The first letters sent by Pony Express from California took 10 days to reach Missouri. The Pony Express lasted only 18 months. It was no longer needed after a telegraph line was completed to San Francisco.
As communications and transportation improved, the government was able to increase its control over the West. But closer ties were not welcomed between the government and a religious group known as the Mormons. The Mormon religion was started by a young New England man named Joseph Smith. In 1823, at the age of 18, Smith claimed that an angel told him of a golden book. He said the book contained God's words to the ancient people of America. Smith said he was able to read the strange writing in this book and put it into English. He called this work the Book of Mormon.
He organized a church and made himself its leader. Many people became Mormons. They believed themselves to be a special people chosen by God. Mormons worked hard. They helped each other and shared with those in need. People who did not agree with the beliefs of the Mormons did not like them. Trouble developed between Mormons and other people. Joseph Smith was forced to move his people from New York to Ohio and then to Missouri. The Mormons seemed finally to have found a home in Illinois. They built their own town and called it Nauvoo. They governed themselves and had their own defense force. The Mormons did so well that Nauvoo became the fastest growing city in Illinois. Then some members of the group split apart because of a new message Smith claimed to have received from God. Smith said God gave permission for Mormons to have more than one wife. This was polygamy, and it was opposed by almost all people. Some of the Mormons who left the church published a newspaper criticizing Smith and the other Mormon leaders. Followers ordered by Smith destroyed the newspaper's publishing equipment. This caused non-Mormons to demonstrate and demand that Smith be punished. Smith was arrested and put in jail in Carthage, Illinois. His brother also was arrested. An angry mob attacked the jail and shot both Smith and his brother to death. The governor of Illinois ordered the Mormons to leave his state. He said only this would prevent further violence. There was no choice. They had to leave. The Mormons had a new leader, Brigham Young. Young decided to take his people west and find a new home for them. He wanted a place where they would be safe, where no one could interfere with their religion. Brigham Young told his people that he had seen their new home in a dream. He said they would search for it in the west, for a wide, beautiful valley. He said he would recognize it when he saw it.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.